So ask yourself this question. What is more meaningful to you? I think I already know the question, but the answer to the question, but you think to yourself for just a moment, what is more meaningful to you? Is it that somebody do a great job the first time, or that they, or that they obey, do a great job or whatever, or that they do a really super job of apologizing? Which is more important to you? A great apology or a job well done? Well, I don't know about you, but a sincere apology can go a long way. I guess somewhat it depends on the severity of the offense. If you just shot my dog and you look at me and go, whoops, I'm sorry, I may not be very happy with you in that moment, no matter how sincere the apology is. And you could do a whole lot worse. Certainly it would be a very difficult thing to recover from. But what I do know is that we are living in a time in our society in which I think people are getting almost tired of apologies. We seem to have crafted a whole social science about how to apologize for things. Now, part of that is in this. I don't know if you've noticed, but people are really easily offended. Did I mention that one of the problems in our society is that people are really easily offended? I don't know. Maybe you didn't catch what I said. Have you noticed that people are really easily offended in our society? It has just like become a national pastime of offense. I the other day, I was just kind of browsing through this page of all kinds of assorted news type of things. And I had already written this, and it just occurred to me as I was looking that how many of the articles were about somebody being offended about something and somebody's grand apology to make up for this said offense. And even as I started to read through some of these things, I kept thinking to myself, are you kidding me? Like, this is what our 3/4 of our news is all about, is somebody got offended by something somebody said or did, and all the energy in these articles is to bring somebody to the point of which they apologize publicly, whether sincere or not, but it has to be really well crafted. And then we get done and we really think to ourselves, was anybody really ever sorry? Was anybody really ever offended? And I'm intrigued at how quickly people pick up other people's offenses. It has become almost a pastime of people being offended for somebody else. I think that's kind of intriguing in and of itself. My curiosity goes to what makes you think that you have the right to be offended over someone else's problem? That is like the epitome of mental unhealth. It really is. If you are offended over what somebody else did to somebody, get over it right now, really. As Bob Newhart would say, stop it! It really, you shouldn't. That's extremely unhealthy. So we have this society now that is running on offense and great apologies. You know, I think that one of the things that you and I need to continually desire in our life is to be quick to forgive and slow to condemn. If for no other reason, the fact that you need it. If for no other reason, the fact that you would like other people to be slow to condemn you and quick to forgive you. And that is bearing heavier and heavier on my mind and my heart. The older I get, that how of little value being hurt and offended has been in my life. And when I look back, how many times that whenever I think about great moments of upheaval in my life that invented deep-seated feelings of offense or people being really angry, and I think to myself, what was that even all about? Like, I don't even remember what I was so upset about or so offended about. And oftentimes when I have a moment to talk to that person, they can't remember either. And you got to understand that I come from a family who loves to hold grudges and be offended. I've got a brother who hasn't talked to most of my siblings in 30 years. We talk once a year. I'm the favorite. Hello? But I haven't seen him since 1989. Do you know, I couldn't tell you for the life of me what made him stop talking to everyone else, including my own mother. I mean, every Mother's Day, one of the thoughts that goes through my head is, I wonder if he will say anything to my mother this year for Mother's Day. One of the things that goes through my head is, I wonder, with Father's Day coming up, if he's ever had to swallow the bitter pill that he's dished out. Because I don't know any of his kids. They could walk up to me in this room right now, and I wouldn't have a clue who they were. He's never met my kids. He's never met my wife. So there's a real issue with offense and the elaborate schemes of apologies that we go through, and nothing ever really gets accomplished in that. And even as we talk about the disagreeable nature of our society, there's another thing that has happened is now that because we have developed such a spirit of offense in our culture and we're so quick to find something grievously wrong with the other person, what they said, what they did, what they implied they might have done, how they looked at you sideways in the supermarket, or how they might have not let you in the passing lane, or whatever else that stirs up the level of offense, is something that I remember saying a whole lot of years ago, and I'm really regretting my participation in it. Sometimes, come on now, you've said this. Okay, maybe not. Maybe it's just me. Sometimes it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And it has become pervasive in our culture to the point that it's moved from sincere apology to a place of just license. Well, I ask for forgiveness. It doesn't really matter. Besides, Jesus will forgive me. And inherently, the nature of so many things in the church today is that as we have developed a culture of license and thin sorrows and offense, so that people are, you know, church hopping and shopping at a record rate, and I understand that sometimes God leads people places and different things like that, but at the same time, one of the things that concerns me as a pastor and receiving people is one of the thoughts, one of the questions in my head always when someone comes and I'm getting to know them is when I hear them talking about their past offenses, things that happened to them, one of the things that I'm doing in the back of my head, forgive me, but I can't help it, is I'm wondering which one of those checks will I have to cash for another pastor? There's a certain level of fear that has crept in there that when people tell me that, oh, you're great, you're different than all the other pastors, that I become very anxious in those moments. And the hardest thing to be a pastor these days is to say to somebody, no. No, I don't think that's wise. No, I don't think that's a good idea. No, you can't do that. We have created a culture in which even that is offensive. Here, too, we come to 1 Samuel chapter 15, and we see a nation in crisis from the top of the leadership all the way down. And the thing is that what we pick up in just through the life of Saul is there is an attitude that is become pervasive in Saul that we saw a little bit of last week. We're going to see it on full display this week with the idea that it's easier to just do than to ask permission and to make grand apologies. And I think that if you and I really want to finish well, we have to ask ourselves the question, is the shortcut really worth it? Is the shortcut really the way that we want to characterize and set our lives in terms of direction? Is the shortcut the way we want to be treated, or the way we just get what we want? Take a look with me, if you will. 1 Samuel chapter 15. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please feel free to read in whatever translation you have on your lap. That one is always my favorite. And Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man, woman, child, infant, ox, sheep, camel, donkey." So Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 men on foot and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and lay in the await in the valley. Then Saul said to the Kenites, "Go, depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. So you showed kindness to all the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites, and Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt, and took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen, of the fattened calves and of the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless, that they devoted to destruction. And the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments." And Samuel turned back from following me and has not. And Samuel was angry and cried to the Lord all night. And Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning. And it was told Samuel, "Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he has set up a monument for himself, and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal." And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed be you to the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." And Samuel said, "What then is the bleating of these sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen that I hear?" And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stop! I tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said, "Speak." And Samuel said, "Though you are little in your own eyes, you are not the head of the tribes of are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go, devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil? Why did you do what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and I have gone on a mission on which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord our God in Gilgal." Samuel said, Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me, that I may bow before the Lord. And Samuel said, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. As Samuel turned to go away, Saul seized the skirt of his robe, and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the glory of Israel will not lie or have regret, for he is not a man that he should have regret. Then he said, I have sinned. Yet honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me, that I may bow before the Lord your God. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul bowed before the Lord. Then Samuel said, bring here to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came to him cheerfully. And he said to himself, surely the bitterness of death is past. And Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. Then Samuel went to Ramah, and Saul went up to his house in Gibeah. And Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. But Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. Some key things stand out to me in this passage. One, as I mentioned last week, Saul has been king for more than 20 years. And in all honesty, his feigned ignorance in this moment is extremely insulting. You ever had somebody feign ignorance with you and you knew that they knew, and they just kind of pretended like they didn't know in that moment, and you wanted to look at them and just wipe that stupid-looking smile off their face? Notice that Saul continually says, your God, distancing himself from responsibility or even knowledge. In fact, one of the things that was intriguing to me is, if you go back and look at this in the original language, is that every time he makes a reference to God, even though it doesn't come through in the English text, the implication is your God, your God, your God, your God. Not a single reference to my God or any sense of identification with Yahweh God, who has made him king. And then there's the despised and the worthless things that they devoted to destruction. All that he thought was worthwhile, they kept alive. On the other hand, I guess we could make an argument, if we weren't reading the whole text, that, well, gee, he was going to sacrifice everything to God. And of course, you always give God your best, right? And so, looky there. What a great guy Saul was being. And yet it is clear that he has proclaimed, I have done everything that the Lord your God wanted. And when Samuel asks him about the bleeding of sheep and the braying of the oxen, that Saul is punting because he's been caught with his hand in the proverbial cookie jar. Oh, that. Well, we were going to, make a big show of this whole thing with Agag. And my wife is Morgan Fairchild. The guy is lying through his teeth, making it up as he's going along. And all of a sudden he says, the people, I know I'm the king, but I couldn't do anything about the people wanted the sheep. The people did it. It's all the people's fault. Really? You ever noticed on sporting teams that the first person to get fired is the coach? First lesson of leadership is you are responsible. He's blaming his troops for his failures. He's making himself a failure. Not just as king, not just as a leader, but really as a man. That he would pass on the blame to everyone else. Guys, I've mentioned this before, and I hope you don't feel like I'm picking on you, but as a guy, I just have to point this out over and over again to us, because we need to hear it. That over and over again in the scripture, when men fail, that it almost always involves men being passive and not speaking up when the right thing to do was in front of them to do it, and they just let other people do what was wrong because they wanted to avoid conflict, or because they didn't feel like speaking up, or because they were afraid, or whatever else. But that the price of our silence is devastating to our families, and that the whole basis of our needing redemption goes back to Adam refusing to speak up when Eve was being tempted. See, we want to put everything on the shoulder of Eve, but can I remind you that in Romans, it doesn't blame Eve. It says Adam. It compares Adam and Christ. And it says that Christ is as different from Adam as they come. And it points out that Christ shoulders the responsibility and that Adam failed to. Right now, there's nothing more shameful than what Saul did in blaming his troops. You are the commander of the troops of Israel. Be a man and say no. Be a man. Command your troops. Be a man. Don't sit here and tell me, I didn't know what to do. They were all they would have been mad at me. Or do you really think, as the king of Israel, he'd never had anybody mad at him before? And it's just insane that he would make such a response. And then there's his lack of concern over God's opinion. I find it intriguing that at the end, he wants Samuel to come make him look good, but that he never once says that he's sorry. He doesn't apologize to Samuel. He doesn't ask the Lord to forgive him. He's just, his only concern is looking good before his men. And I think the only reason Samuel joined him was because at that moment, he probably feared for his own life. Because the guy who would hack the other king to pieces just to make himself look good, well, who knows what he might do to Samuel if he made him look bad. And we see over and over again where Samuel or Saul thinks nothing of killing the priest and other things when he thinks that they're siding with David. Don't think that he's a man above hacking Samuel to pieces either. No, what we're doing is we're getting this very rapid look into the life of Saul, the man who has been king over Israel for 20 years, who took a nation that was prosperous, who took a nation that was didn't need defending, that no wars had come to its shores, and now he is continually in war after war after war. They are in great poverty, and even now when God gives him some very simple tasks to complete, he can't even do those in true obedience. Now, I know for all of us, you know, I understand that being a 21st century American Christian, that it is very hard for me to get my head around things in the biblical text like the wiping out of an entire group of people. And that's just really horrifying to the Western mind. I got to tell you that as long as I've been reading the Bible, as much as I've studied the Bible, as much as I know the answers to all those things, here's the thing. I still have to tell you, it just makes it hard for me. I read that and I go, wow. But I got to make the point to you that this is not a Western worldview that we're reading. It's the biblical worldview in which all people are created by God, and the length of their life and the date of their death and so forth is all decided before they draw their first breath, and that the decisions of life and death belong to God alone as creator. Secondly, the biblical worldview says that it's better to end a cycle of destructive behavior and to root it out rather than to let it to continue to pass from generation to generation. Thus, the flood was a cleansing of the world. And in the end, there will be a final judgment, at which point those who surrender to God will go on to new life, to the new heavens, the new earth. But those who do not surrender face destruction. I know it's still hard to get our heads around, but the biblical worldview is not necessarily your and I, the worldview that you and I have. See, this is the biblical worldview like this. Now, let me show you. This is the biblical worldview that are the way most people view the Bible whenever they read it. And just to make it interesting, and God's got a bottle of jerks he's shaking over the earth. This is not the biblical worldview, okay? So, I know that a lot of us have this view sometimes that of kind of the blind watchman, just doing whatever he does to the earth and shaking things up and tormenting and things like that. But that's not the biblical worldview. The biblical worldview is one in which God lovingly holds all things in his hands, and he's the author and creator of all things. But as such, he knows the beginning from the end. He holds the whole germ of life in his hand and is the author of life and death. So in the case of the Amalekites, when we talk about them being devoted to destruction, we're not talking about one day of their life being taken before it was written down that it would be taken. And so we have this different perspective that we have to step back from for just a moment. Let go of my Western feelings and just hear for a moment that that's what happened, regardless of whether we feel comfortable with it or uncomfortable with it. And in this case, the Amalekites have continually just poisoned the land and done things that were destructive. And the deal is that King Saul, when he didn't destroy them, did not do so to preserve them out of some kind of noble cause. It wasn't like King Saul said, well, you know, I was raised in a Christian home, and we don't do things like that. That's not why he preserved them. He didn't preserve them because he felt pity for them. He didn't preserve them because he felt merciful that day. It's not like he came before the Lord and said, Lord, I just couldn't destroy them because I felt this great sense of remorse in what I was doing, and so I took mercy on them, and that we will deal with them. I would rather deal with them than kill them. No, Saul's whole entire reasoning is, hey, look, we could get some good cattle out of this. We can get some others. And I could like make Agag, put him on a chain, make him like a pet and make him tell me about advice. I'll keep him alive. And who knows what I might do to him to make myself look good. Saul is all about Saul. But there's nothing noble. In fact, if you want to proof of that, just look at the simple fact that what does he destroy? He destroys the weak. Can I tell you, church, that there's nothing more grievous, no greater stench in the nostrils of God as you read through the minor prophets than those who are strong preying on those who are weak and cannot defend themselves? That the cause of justice in the Bible is always at the aspect of that we do right, especially by those who cannot defend themselves. Instead, he preyed upon the weak and showed himself the complete antithesis of everything that a godly king should be. But he keeps the things he likes. He decides what he wants, the spoils of war, choice animals. It says, and other good things. I'm assuming there's probably some women in there that he desired and kept for himself. And then, of course, King Agag. And Saul just shows us his true colors when he says, you know, it's kind of like hashtag. Here we go. Give me the hashtag. You aren't the boss of me. I do what I want when I want to. And he did. But Saul was appointed king by God and gave God all the evidence he needed, from miracles to prophetic words to a whole nation taking this unknown person by force and making him king. Why, Saul, on the other hand, rather than trust God to keep him in power, has turned his back on God. He's used manipulation, we saw last week, trying to keep himself in power. And now he's power brokering to stay in power. Saul is not any different than any of the kings around him in the other nations. And then we remember the words of Israel. We want a king just like everybody else. And we remember God's heart and his fear for his people. And as he warned them, if your king will follow me and pursue me, I will preserve you all the days of your life. I will prosper you. But if he is not, I will deal with you just like all the other people. And what I find intriguing in this whole story is this, that when we hear the heart of Samuel and we hear the heart of God, they don't want to see Saul fail. God gave him every chance to succeed. He's already told him once, look, you've failed, you did these things. I'll have no more of you, but I am not going to preserve your family line. One of your descendants will not sit on the throne because I can't trust you. And then and the next thing he does is he runs out and he violates God's will, goes against God's heart all over again to the point that God says, and now I'm going to cut short your reign because you just won't stop. And then he makes this great show of his apology. We watch over and over again as just Saul makes great show after great show. In fact, when we go on a little bit further and we look at his conflict with David, one of the things that's intriguing is every time David spares his life, that Saul puts on this grand show. Oh, David, my son. Oh, how my heart is grieved over you. If your heart was grieved over you, why don't you let him come back? Liar. His heart isn't grieved. Well, maybe just a little bit. His heart's grieved that his hand got caught in the cookie jar again. Anybody ever been sad because your hand got caught in the cookie jar? Hello? But you can't play church with God. Saul's going to get all gussied up for church. Going to drop a big wad in the offering plate in front of everyone, make a big production of going to the altar to get prayer. Then he's going to wail and weep over his sins at the altar and then get up and go do the same thing because nothing has changed in his heart. He won't even be out in the church parking lot before everything is all back to the same inside. And God calls this type of show-off, hype, no heart religion, divination. See, whenever we think of divination and witchcraft and things like that, our minds have been so scandalized by Hollywood and by 17th and 18th century literature that we have this idea that everything is like somebody's conjuring up some magical spell out of some big book and wearing a pointy hat and doing things, and we think that that is the idea of witchcraft. And the biblical view of witchcraft is when humans try to manipulate spiritual forces to make them do what they want to get the result that they want. And I would dare say that some people pray like witchcraft. Hello? You can't manipulate the true and living God. And when we do... It's just like witchcraft. It's offensive to God. We worry sometimes and we think, well, I'm not like that. I don't worship false gods. But when you try to manipulate Yahweh God through religious ceremony, well, I haven't been to church in a while. I'll go to church and that'll make me feel better, and then everything will be okay. I mean, you know what? I haven't given in a while. I'll make a big offering on Sunday because I've got this thing and I want God to intervene in my situation. You know what I'll do? I've been having a really rough time. I'm going to pray and fast so that God will give me what I want. And in essence, what we're really trying to do is manipulate God. And it says that God searches the heart. He knows who we are. The good news is he doesn't seem to get tired of our earnest apologies when we bow down before him in our hearts, not even physically. Maybe you say, well, I can't even get down on my knees. My knees aren't too bad. I can't. You know what? When we turn our hearts to God and we surrender ourselves and we ask him for mercy and forgiveness, he's quick to give it. But folks, be honest before the Lord. Don't manipulate him. You see, what it says is that obedience is better than sacrifice. Understand, the sacrifices that God gave to them were to cover up the sin. God didn't want the sacrifices. What he wanted was obedience. And so the sacrifices were put there to deal with the fact that there was a lack of obedience. God gave them sacrifices to atone for sin. See, that's what the disobedience is. It's sin. But not as a license to commit sin. In essence, King Saul was treating the sacrifice kind of like an indulgence. You know, in Protestant churches, there's quick to judge the Catholic Church over the history of indulgences. But church, what's the difference between us going to church and maybe even putting tithes in something like that in an effort to try to appease the heart of God when we've done whatever we've wanted to? I don't know that there's really any significant difference. Maybe we'd be better off, instead of complaining to the Catholic Church about what they do, and examine our own hearts about what we do. So Saul uses his apology as a license. And eventually his attitude becomes a stench to God. If all we want is a license, well, that is not Christianity. That is, in essence, the religion of man. You see, if you and I want to finish well, the thing that comes to me again and again as we look through these texts, as we look at the life of Saul and Samuel and Hannah and David and all, is that God isn't looking for well-crafted apologies or extravagant gifts. He's not even looking for great church attendance or outward shows of behavior. What God is looking for and desires in us is pure hearts and clean hands, and that he gives us his Holy Spirit to indwell within us so that we can become, so that we can change, so that we can be transformed, so that our minds can be renewed, and that we can hang on to the promises of Romans 12, that if we will renew our minds, that we will understand what his good, pleasing, and perfect will is, and then empower us to do that good, pleasing, and perfect will. And then that the sacrifices of God, of the spilt blood that runs down the cross of Calvary, it's okay. I will pick you up when you stumble. I will give you a fresh start when you can't walk anymore. I will give you my Holy Spirit to stir your heart and to set you in direction. But that it's not a license to do as we please. Saul. Oh, Saul. So gifted. So capable. With every means necessary to be a great king. Except repentance. Psalm 40, verses 6 through 8, we read these words. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written about me. I delight to do your will, O God. My law, your law is within my heart. The biggest difference between David who writes that and Saul who didn't is a heart that's on fire for God. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 6 through 8 later on tell us in reference to that passage that Jesus is speaking about himself, about Jesus Christ through that Jesus' sacrifice was better than bulls, better than goats, because a bull and a goat, they don't give their lives for you willingly. They die because you make them die. But Jesus, he died for you and I because he surrendered his life. So that finishing well isn't sliding into home safe at the end. Finishing well is you and I each day intentionally living a way that brings glory and honor to God. Not just looking at a way to avoid hell. Not just looking at a way to be okay. But a lifestyle of obedience. Because a lifestyle of obedience is more important than an apology. You know, the thing is, I've discovered, you probably know it's true. You and I don't come to Jesus in style. We come to Jesus in a humility of recognizing that our pride is the source of our sin. We come to Christ needing to lay down our pride and asking for forgiveness. And we say things like, Jesus, I've sinned against you and against others. I've lied, I've cheated, I've stolen, I've gossiped, I've thought evil about my enemies. Please forgive me and save me from myself, from destruction. Make me yours. Add me to your forever kingdom. And you know, the thing is I know when I prayed that prayer for the very first time, like that myself, that I did so with snot and tears running down my face. It wasn't a very proud moment. You know, the thing is that every time I've watched somebody sincerely come to Christ and watch radical life transformation, I've watched them do so with a sense of humility, of recognition of their need for God. And the thing that continually separates those who walk along with the Lord and see his life come to fruit in their life are those who choose humility, who choose to live a new life rather than make grand apologies or try to look good in front of men. Oh. So how do we do it? How do we finish well? Well, sometimes it's appropriate that we just simply man up to some things. It's a time to own what we've done or don't do and to not put it off on anyone else. It's not my wife's fault. It's not my children's fault. It's not my coworker's fault. It's not anybody else's fault. It's not the people who report to me's fault. It's not the people above me's fault. I own my own stuff. God, would you walk with me from here? Would you change my heart? Would you begin to do things in me? And maybe it's time to grab somebody next to you and ask them to hold you accountable. Ask somebody to help you walk through the sin issues in your life so that you can not only recover, but continue to walk with the Lord. Maybe it's a matter of taking your own heart captive again and again. But here's what I know. That we walk in a grace-filled, Holy Spirit-empowered life when we come to Christ. And it's not that we do it perfectly, but that the desire of our heart is obedience more than sacrifice. And here's what else I know. That if you're still here, still sucking air, still consuming resources on the earth, did you know that God still has plans and intent for your life to extend the good news of his kingdom, to bring hope and healing through you to others, to be the minister of reconciliation? Maybe it's to share your life with others. Maybe it's to disciple some. Maybe it's just simply desiring to show others what it looks like to finish well. But church, there is still a call on your life. And it doesn't matter how young you are, how old you are. The call on his life is for you and for me to finish well. Let's stand together. So, Holy Spirit of God, we just invite you.